kind of a speaker's privilege and pick up on one or two things that I have sat on listening to other presentations or have arisen in conversation. The first is that after this morning when we were talking about factors which compromise the exercise of free will, one of the factors you may remember was sickness or disease, and I was talking with Cor actually, and he made the point that even in sickness, say for example also in depression, there are times when you can still, as it were, reach out and claim your free will, or if not at that moment, then in days afterwards, there, in reflecting on an event, you can then have the opportunity to exercise your free will. And I didn't say it to Cor at the time, but it ties in when Glenn was talking yesterday about temptation. Temptations are by no means necessarily of the present event or circumstance. Temptation can arise 3 months after the event because you start to mull over it or think about it or question your reaction to it, which you haven't done for all of those weeks or whatever it's been since that event took place. And I was tempted to say something to somebody, or I may even have said something to say somebody which I didn't mean to say, which didn't particularly worry me at the time, but 6 weeks later I find myself thinking about that, and that thinking about it can often be, it can often trigger and bring me into a state of temptation about it. The other thing I wanted to say by way of introduction, well, not just so much introduction, is that when Brian was talking, I wanted to ask him, but I didn't, because I didn't want to stop or detract in any way, sidetrack from his presentation. And that is, I've long been very impressed by the fact that the Roman Catholic Church has in many ways at least appeared to me to be at the forefront, in the vanguard of marriage counselling, marriage support, all those things which come from a church which idealises celibacy. And so, you know, that's always been a kind of a contradiction to me, that you've got that. And I was going to ask you during the session, what do you make of this? Because I know you're working, under the auspices of a Catholic organisation, or recently have been, and I still haven't unpacked and unravelled that. However, having said that, it's a dated book now, but at the time I did clinical pastoral education training at Royal North Shore Hospital, I was introduced to a book by a Jesuit priest called John Powell, and his book is titled The Secret of Staying in Love. And whilst I often throw out books that have been on my shelves simply because I've had to, and I think it's important to keep my books, relatively either up to date, it's one book I've kept, and I'll tell you the reason I've kept it. Because it's like something which was seared into my mind when I read it. And he says in that book that love is a decision commitment. And I thought, wow. And I thought about that, and I've come to realize how utterly true that is. We think love is a feeling, and we say, well, the feeling has washed away. What rubbish. It may have done, but you can make a decision commitment. You pick up one of those passages you can choose to love about causes of cold and what you've got to do and this and apparent love and this kind of thing. But Swedenborg doesn't actually say it, but it gets so close. And then when John Powell said, look, love is a decision commitment. Make certain decisions and you'll find that the thing will start turning around. Never forgotten that. That's from a Roman Catholic priest. If you ever see the book in a second-hand bookshop, that is one, it's only a little paperback, but if you see it, it's worth picking up. The Secret of Staying in Love by the Jesuit priest, John Powell. It's an orangey red cover. I wanted now to give you some more. I'm glad somebody said they like and quite appreciate the handout sheets, because I need now to... There's two handout sheets for this session, and this is this one here. Here's the bride.
She was cold. You're freezing, Angela. She thinks this is some of the things in the
world. Before we ought to cover. Anyhow, we may get a chance after. Can I just also pick up what I said? Now, this may sound like justification, but it's not. I want to say something about what Brian was talking about this morning, just very quickly, with regard to Exodus 34. Who can tell me what Exodus 34 is all about? But what about the commandments? They come for a second time. Now, what about the second time? Who made the tablets the first time? Who made the tablets the second time? Right. Now, if you remember, Brian used the word deconstruction. And that's what I fastened on to and what I spoke up to. And he also used another word about when he was talking about Genesis 34 and the rape of Dinah and things like that, about sensuality and the sensual level of our being and this kind of thing. If you just bring those two things together, those two words of deconstruction and sensuality, then you have got the key to understanding Exodus 34. Because there's been a deconstruction. The commandments have been given on tablets, carved there by the finger of God, but the people are unable to cope. The writings are all on about the fact that the form of the word was simply beyond them to grasp. Why? Because they were in such an external and sensual state. So Exodus 34 is simply telling us how the Lord responded and responds to us when we're in these external sensual states. And what occurred to me, Brian, is that whilst you were looking at just from Exodus 34 and Shechem and things like that, and the brothers of the sons of Jacob, and all the way they murdered them, well, you know, there is the two chapters are actually connected. Because like I said yesterday, here you have the Lord in Genesis dealing with the whole thing of the sensual within him. But in Exodus, as those of you who are here remember, what were we dealing with? If Genesis is dealing with glorification, what is Exodus dealing with? Redemption. Liberation. So, what you've got is you exploring Exodus 34. Genesis 34 is exploring the Lord's work with the sensual degree. And in Exodus 34, you've got the Lord in his ability to redeem the sensual. There's nothing wrong with the sensual, but and the key is its redemption. So, I mean, that's a glorious thing that the new church teaches and holds up to the world, that the sensual degree is never to be despised. I mean, you look at the history of the early Christian church for the first 300 years. People used to go and sit on poles 40 feet above the ground to deny themselves the reality of the sensual. But the new church is saying, No, the Lord has the capacity to redeem the sensual so that it becomes the servant of all the higher degrees and levels of our being. So I saw a wonderful connection in what you were saying this morning. And I think I would just put it to you without, you know, without doing my study or my checking, Glenn, that I think it's a lovely thing to think that Genesis 34 and Exodus 34 under the Lord's providence, I just think it's a wonderful thing that you spoke as you did, even talking about, because I did pick it up, where you were, and yet here in the Lord's providence, this whole area, you dealing with it from glorification, from Genesis, and here it is dealt with in the very same numbered chapter in Exodus. A lovely link. So thank you for what you did this morning, and what it's certainly for what it stirred and awakened within me. I'd like to just tell you that when we were talking with Sally, when I was talking with Sally this morning, Ruth will remember that back in her Birmingham days, a calendar of daily readings from Swedenborg was published. Remember it, Ruth?
Yeah, we've redone it.
I know you've redone it. Yeah. I'm not as keen as the redone one because the quotations are shorter.
Yeah.
And so I keep as although it's falling apart.
Yeah.
And what I found, and I've given to you now, I've simply given you a copy of the page for January 29th, the week of beginning January the 29th, because it has revelation. And it really got me thinking. I thought, my, I really like some of this. And again, like I said to you with regard to the other presentations I've given, I made a note of this, thinking about the seminar, and said to David, look, I really like to take up the subject of God communicating with us, which is revelation. This is what I'm on about. Revelation. God communicating with us. This is what it's about. Now, I quite like, not myself, because you have my voice enough, but maybe Kevin could read the first column of these quotations from what is January the 29th downwards.
From 1878-0, revelation here does not mean in the internal sense the kind of revelation made to the Israelite people from Mount Sinai. That is to say, when the Lord spoke to an audible voice and the people standing around heard it. Rather, it means a revelation that is not made with an audible voice, but is received by a person inward. This revelation is made through enlightenment of inner sight, when a person with an affection for truth, free from good, reads the word. When the understanding is enlightened by that divine light, it perceives that to be truth, which is truth, and inwardly acknowledges it, so to speak, sees it. From Sacred Scripture 26. The Lord teaches everyone by means of the word. He teaches him from those truths already written to man. He does not infuse new truths immediately. From AC 5121, genuine perception comes from the Lord through heaven. It builds understanding of spiritual ideas and leisure as it may be perceived. To think about the minds of and inwardly recognize the true nature of a thing. The source of that power of recognition is not mine, but the understanding and magic that it begins within itself. It springs from the intellectual idea and has its credit within itself. But in fact, that power is a dictate coming from the Lord by way of telling it in two parts of one's thought, regarding the things that are above and beyond the natural and the spiritual senses, that is, the kinds of things that belong to the spiritual world or to heaven. From AE 1177. The Lord teaches no one without the use of means, but by such means as are within man's reach. There is no direct revelation. So that which has been given in the Word is nature such that everyone may be taught from it according to the effects of his love and the thought of his understanding tends to rise. Those who are not in the good of life can be taught very little, but those who are in the good of life can be taught much, for they are taught by the enlightenment from the Lord.
Now, I'm just going to stop a little bit on the topic of the Lord communicating with us. You know, as a minister and a spiritual teacher, again, you can subscribe to it and give it lip service, but it's something that only really, for me, has owned me, and that is that I can't teach anybody. I cannot teach anybody. And I cannot quantify, I cannot identify, I cannot, and I'll never know what you take from the words that utter from my mouth. And I know that because, as I'm sure Brian, I'm sure David, I'm sure anybody who has taught, Glenn given a sermon, and people have come out and thanked me for something that I didn't know I'd said. Because what I said has obviously triggered something which the Lord has worked with and brought to their consciousness. And there it must rest. Only the Lord can convey insight, understanding, awareness. We can bring it to people, but the Lord takes it from there. And I can truthfully say that one of my prayers, Sully, every day, and particularly when I'm called upon to preach, is that the Lord will use what I've prepared in His way, with His people, for His purposes. And if I've prepared well, I leave it at that. I've come to leave it at that. So that's the first thing I want to say about the Lord communicating with us. The second thing I want to say to you is that books alone do not convey what the Lord Himself wants to convey to you. Be careful. I 100% endorse what you say, David, that with the writings we're dealing with sacred text. I believe that with my heart, that we're dealing with sacred text. But we are not dealing with the spiritual sense of the word. The spiritual sense of the word can only be given by the Lord. The writings give us an idea and a knowledge of the spiritual sense of the word. They do not give us the spiritual sense of the word. The spiritual sense of the word is disclosed to people as they journey through their regeneration. And no other way. You will have a knowledge of what you think is the spiritual sense of the word from reading the writings, but you will not have the spiritual sense of the word. The writings are utterly clear on this. It's particularly in the little book Doctrine of the Sacred Scriptures that the spiritual sense is disclosed only to those who are in the work of regeneration, even though they do not know it. People can be in possession of the spiritual sense of the word even though they are ignorant of it. Isn't that a wonderful thing? There's many people out there who are in an awareness of the spiritual sense of the word, even though they cannot always verbalize it and certainly will not put it in the terminology that you're used to from the books of the writings. But they still have it. They must have it if you believe what the writings say about people's regeneration being the key to him being able to what? You've already had the word. Enlighten. The word is enlighten. And enlightenment is to be identified with the inner or spiritual sense of the word, because your regeneration is bringing you increasingly into the company of the angels with whom in your regeneration, again a quotation from the writings, you are actually sharing your thoughts and they are sharing their thoughts with you. Isn't that amazing? They are sharing their thoughts with you and you are sharing their thoughts with your thoughts with them. I want you to see that the Lord's communication with us is in that area, and it is full of that sort of wonder. So don't see the spiritual sense as confined to readers of the writings. You've no right to. And what is interesting as well is where the writings say that people can be in an awareness of the truth and in their hearts know the truth, but if you challenge them, they will trot out the doctrinal formulations of the church they've been brought up in. So it's I think, counterproductive to challenge people's doctrine, because within themselves, if they're striving to live a godly life, they're moving already into the spiritual sense. Okay? So do not think of the spiritual sense in the narrow readership of the writings, and do not think of the spiritual sense as being accessible and available to people who are in the organizations of the new church. It is much bigger than that. It is much bigger than that. And I think when you start to edge towards an appreciation of this, you start towards edging towards a sense of the extent of the incoming Holy City, New Jerusalem.
I think with the chapters of Exodus and what we spoke about in your session, Ian, about the fact that the representations aren't it. The representations are not it. They are not the church. Neither are the representations by which we formulate an idea, words at this level, perceptions at a celestial level, insight from conscience at a spiritual level. What's formulated is not the spiritual sense. The spiritual sense is the light in which they're formulated, and the formulation is a representation that enables light to be present.
The thing you said about communicating with our ideas with angels and sharing them, I think that remembering that will be very helpful to me to help what we were doing this morning, being more receptive when reading. So if you think you're sharing ideas with an angel, I think that will help me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a passage in the writings, Ruth, which very specifically, which talks about that also very specifically with the Holy Supper.
Yeah.
That if you are in some sense of what this is about, your need for the Lord's strength and guidance and that sort of thing, the angels, with their much greater insight and appreciation of what's going on, are able to, I think their words there, are they mingling their thoughts with yours on that? And I think that's just a lovely thought, that this mingling of thoughts going on in that way. So, yeah. Well, of course, Ruth, we could move across into the reading of the word, for the way in which that attracts, acts as a wonderful magnet to the angels. Swedenborg said that he picked up a copy of the Bible on one occasion and he was flicking through it just like that, and I guess stopping and doing this kind of thing, and he, like you were saying, with his own awareness, he was aware that as he did that, and he quotes the likes of Malachi and so on, he's saying he was aware of the shift of the different societies of angels or communities of the heavens who were swirling around and brought into focus as each of those, as his eyes rested on the different parts and books of the of the literal sense. So Ruth, we could really get into that. I just want to now, because of the time, I just want to move very quickly. We could have done a lot more on the angels, but I can give you also, I have actually got it, Ruth, and I'll give it to you, friends, because this is on your very point. This is my other hand, actually, on the communication of angels with us. For example, in heaven, it is not the historical descriptions of the world that are perceived, but the things that those descriptions mean. Spiritual sense flows into the natural sense, as the sun does with its own light into the moon, causes it to appear in immediate manner, and so on. So take that, but just don't read it, because of the time constraint, I just want to pick up with you something else. I couldn't help, because Brian, it was on my own mind, I couldn't help thinking of, in fact, all today, in one way or another, it's been on my mind, but I just wanted us to spend a few minutes on communication between ourselves, and how we communicate, and how we, effectively or otherwise, communicate and convey where we are at and what states we are in. And I'll use the board for this because if you just call out what are the ways we communicate. I'll start you off. We communicate, for example, by silence, and sometimes very powerfully by silence. If you don't answer somebody who said something, or if you don't comment on something, that's a powerful communication. So, well, how are, what are the different ways we have of communicating? Body language. We certainly have body language, and body language is of course huge, and it's very much backed up in the writings, Philip, because it says that every state which we are in has a correspondence in our physical bodies. Every state. We all see it. We can read people through their eyes. And so I just loathe it when people go on television and wear sunglasses when they're interviewed. I cannot stand it, because the eyes are the most powerful indicator of the states that people are in. And to wear sunglasses, I think, is borrowed, because I think it's rude to the people who are watching the interview. And so I just turn off when I see somebody who hasn't had the grace to take off their sunglasses. Sunglasses. So how else then do we?
Tone and volume.
So
voice.
So we've got language there, haven't we? And you're saying we've got tone. Yes, go ahead.
Volume
and pitch. Yeah. How else then? Writing. Of course, we can do that. Writing, yes. How else do we communicate with each other?
Touch
is huge. Somebody said pictures. Okay.
Haven't got the eyes down here.
Eyes.
Yeah.
Windows. Windows.
How about flowers?
Of course, Skype now. Right.
Skype.
Okay. Something else? I'm really trying
but
to...
But there's two
through me, I know it's a subconscious thing, but you pick up on each other's work. Exactly.
Spears.
That's very... Gary, I looked around on our... Big Ben? Sorry?
Yeah, five.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think clothes too. People choose clothes.
They do.
I think my tie is very conscious.
Well, you see, a crowd of young people all wearing black, in the cities, and that's a statement. That's they're saying something. It's like the separation, I think.
Yeah.
You were going to say you picked up on the spirit? You arrived?
I always monitor spirits. I monitored this seminar from Thursday afternoon onwards. I picked up the difficulties people were having, adjusting to it. I was watching all the time how others were handling and managing it, and where they were moving in regard to the sphere that was slowly emerging. I want to say that groups can be formidable, and they can be such that you can feel really marginalized by groups. Or you can feel included. We've got to watch this, not just in terms of seminars, but whenever we come together in a group, we need to become increasingly sensitive to the sphere which we are part of, not only are participating in, but are contributing to. And I mean, I've had to do this. Anybody, I look at Ben on my left hand here, or Dave, or anybody who's in working with groups and things like that, particularly in church, I'm shocked at times at the familiarity and assumptions that we as a group can project as part of our sphere, which make it extremely difficult for people to join or be amongst. And I think we should not be so blasé about the group dynamic as if that is secondary to the wonderful teachings the new church possesses. I actually think the group dynamic is the all-important thing when it comes to the excluding or the including of the timid, and most people are timid, the timid inquirer. And I have shared this with Mary and Glenn, and there may be other explanations, but I was quite shocked when somebody very recently, early this year, so nothing to do with more recent developments, got on the phone and said, "How are you?" And this person said, "Well, I actually find you as a group very unfriendly." I nearly died. And did that make me sit up and think, why would somebody say that? Been to the church about 5 or 6 times. My goodness, it's a long time since somebody said that to me. And then I thought about it, and I thought, I don't know how, I haven't got easy solutions to it, but I'm going to finish now, but I just wanted to say that it made me revisit things like familiarity with the people we know. It made me revisit the conversations that we so easily find easy to slip into when we know each other. It made me revisit the fact, which I've kept myself for ever since, that I didn't take an opportunity on one of the occasions to say, "Look, this is so and so, and I'd like you to make the effort to welcome such and such that person." there's lots of things that have gone through me thinking about it, but I have come to this conclusion that we must not underestimate the power of the sphere that any group in which we are participants is generating. We need to all take responsibility for it. It is not just David's responsibility, it's not just my responsibility. We all need to take responsibility for it. And like I said, and I reiterate, I've now become convinced that the sphere is more important than anything when it comes to including or excluding the timid inquirer.
You can go now.
Thank you. Thanks very much.